Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. Today I'm talking to a very dear friend of mine and former mentor, Scott Selden, who I met at the then College of Santa Fe in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He is a mentor, life coach, photographer, author who regularly mentors people with disabilities. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me as a guest on your show. It's such an incredible contribution that you're making. So I want to honor that right from the start.
Thank you very much. We are here today to talk about the College of Santa Fe, how we met, and your new memoir, which is called Out of the Blue, My Out of the Blue Stories, One Man's Journey to Life. We'll put the image up clear on the website and in the promo. I just finished it the other night, and like I was telling you in the preamble before we started recording, I did not expect the format of the book, some 60-odd short stories, to really be that engaging. And I thought I knew you, and I did know you so well once upon a time, but reading your book, it illuminated so much more to me. And so your book and the format you chose is excellent.
Well, thank you. And the format came quite naturally, because my approach was to start with my earliest memories and to go through each year and to try to recall any story from that year. I could be 2 years old, 4 years old, 6 years old, any story that has stayed with me and still has meaning for me, and that might have meaning for other people. So that's how the format came. You know, some of the stories are maybe five or six sentences, the earliest ones.
Yeah. And I also found out that Scott is your middle name and yeah, not your first name, that you were born premature as well.
Well, no, I wasn't born prematurely. That opening about being in utero?
Yes.
Well, let me see if I can find it here. I started with not a memory of being in utero, but something happened during that time.
Oh, okay.
And for viewers, it's such a brief story, I could just read it. Though I don't remember being in utero, I imagine it is dark and I'm living in a sack of amniotic love. My timeless world is sweet and secure. I explore it gently with my legs and hands, comforted by muffled sounds. Suddenly, the world I've been living in for 7.5 months disappears when my mother is told that her father has died. I'm immersed in her grief, and time begins for me. So,
yeah, I can see the confusion and the assumption I jumped to, but thank you for explaining it.
Yeah, sure. And my mother was an exquisitely loving human being. So being in the pre-birth amniotic sac, I imagine, must have just been bliss for any being in that situation. And then when she hears that she's told, and she doesn't know that her father is ill and is dying, when she's told that, the grief is overwhelming. And in my imagination, I think that must have totally changed my world and had impact in subtle and maybe not so subtle ways throughout my life in terms of the extremes of love and bliss, and the extremes of experiencing grief and having empathy for people and compassion for people, because when you feel what someone else is feeling, it reminds me of a Bob Marley quote from a song, a quote from a song where he sings, only he who feels it knows it.
Yeah, that's very, very true. I've been thinking about you a lot and how we first met at the college. It must have been the fall of 2017, sorry, of 2007. yeah, big difference. And you were probably one of the first people I had met at TRIO, which was the college's Disability Resource Center, as it was.
As
other
well,
than that,
well, we work with people with disabilities, and we also worked with the first generation to go to college, and also people who had financial difficulties growing up in families. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously became fast professional and close friends throughout the years, but I am trying to remember some of the first impressions I had of you, and I've told you this before, that time seems like several lifetimes ago, to be honest. It's very funny how time rearranges things, certain memories. You mentioned having a clear memory of my New York apartment, and I do have a clear memory of your office at the college. But what was said, how we were introduced, I'm blanking on.
I remember it. You came into my office with your parents, and we sat down. We talked. We introduced ourselves, and my impression of your parents was that they were very supportive and loving people, that and they had come with you to ease this introduction to me and to our department. And what I really liked about the way it unfolded was that they were not controlling of of our time together. They allowed space for you to emerge as who you are. And I really appreciated that, and it spoke very well of the two of them. And we did become fast friends. There was something that we understood about each other, at least this was my impression, my sense, memory, that we understood something about each other, there's some people you just really connect with, and you just have a sense of who they are, and that it's a safe space. And that's how I remember our meeting.
Over the 3 or 4 years, I think it was 3.5 actually, we became quite close because we shared a similar philosophy towards life, and it expanded as I tried to navigate the college scene and being immersed in the town of Santa Fe, or the city, excuse me, city of Santa Fe. And it what I'd learned through your memoir is this type of mentoring is nothing new to you. You have done it in one form or another for decades upon decades. And I mean, there are so many stories in this book that bear mentioning and bear and are worth talking about. And that's even before we get to the section on Santa Fe. And where you mention me, and then you mention Daniel, and then you continue. I love how it ends, and it goes right back. It has that beginning edge of when you yourself were in college, and you've been down this road before. That's the final sentence of the book, and I'm of the memoir, and I'm like, I know exactly what he means by that. It's like the chapter titles are so apt. I know more about your family through this book than when we trained. When we trained together as mentor and mentee. You're famously one of the most or more reclusive persons I've met. And that's not a bad thing at all. It's just who you are and who you developed. In reading the book, I can see exactly why, on some of the reasons why you have developed the way you have.
Well, to put it in a sentence, it's rough out there.
Yes, indeed.
It really is. And for self-protection, it's so easy to lose what you feel is best in yourself when you try to fit into a culture that is highly competitive, and often disdainful of those that are perceived as in some way lesser than how you might think of yourself or where you think you are in the hierarchy of bullshit status, And I have a keen memory of my first year in college and how alone I felt. And I didn't know who I could trust. I didn't know who was there to help me. There really were at the time very few people. I don't remember going to a mentor or a coach or anybody. And you learn what you don't know. And it's rough. It's rough.
One thing I really appreciated and liked immensely about your book is about your memoir is the stories were so diverse, even the stories that took place in the same place. You weren't treading same ground. You weren't repeating yourself. The characters came alive. The only thing that would have made the reading experience more enjoyable is if you had done a audiobook version, because sorry, I forgot there was a active phone line behind me, and so I had to remove it. As I was saying, the stories were so personal and evocative that even without an audiobook version, and I geek out over audiobooks all the freaking time. I mean, it's unreal. I could appreciate the amount of detail you put into each scene, and it made me feel like I was alive and right there with you from your childhood up until this moment right now. And that's how, when the book works and it's effective, when the reader can imagine they were actually there in every room, every scene with you. And so your book is incredible.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you. That's really what I had hoped it, the effect that it would have on the reader, that they would be brought in. It's first person. This is happening now, and I tried not to put anything that didn't belong in the story. So it has this, a spareness and a fullness, I think, at simultaneously.
Yes, it definitely does. So let's get to
Yeah.
all back to the college and the section that we came up with, but that you really spearheaded in my mind, and I'll read it verbatim from your book. Because it's only like five paragraphs, but that's all it needs to be, five paragraphs. That's how concise you are as a writer. 2011, this is page 149 in the book. It's year 2011. It probably actually happened in 2008, but there's a reason why you put it at 2011 that will become clear. The disability and ability of love. During the years that I worked at the College of Santa Fe, I coached many students who had diagnosed disabilities. This story is about someone named Daniel. But before I introduce you to him, I'll share a few relevant paragraphs from a book I wrote, Mentoring Human Potential, published in 2011 by iUniverse. Quote, step into the world of your mentees as you step more deeply into your own world. Is your limited ability to love, turning those with documented disabilities into other. Keith Murphy, name used with permission, is a student I mentored with who had cerebral palsy. I excerpt from a sermon Keith wrote and gave at his church in Washington, D.C. Quote, having a disability is challenging, but it shouldn't lead to a depressed life. However, it often does because of the mindset people without disabilities have towards people with them. A friend and mentor, Scott Selden, suggested I write a piece entitled The Disability of Love. I was intrigued by the concept. We all have a disability, whether we know it or not, accepted or rejected. It is the need for love, the lack of awareness we bring to our inability to love. It's the disability that haunts us all. It is the common ground of life.
You
I
really.
was a very young pup when I wrote those words. I had just gotten fresh out of high school. I like to use metaphor and analogy. And while those words still hold some truth, I've fleshed them out even more years later. But what about that passage struck you enough to include it in not just one book you wrote, Mentoring Human Potential, but also your memoir?
Well, the disability of love is like a plague on humanity. While we're talking, there's such killing going on in the Middle East. It's unspeakable killing. You can't even, but the disability of love, we see it expressed. In when I earlier I said it's rough out there. It's rough because there is this disability of love. And I this really expresses what I feel is the most important thing that we can discuss. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, we're going to probably discuss that during this episode. And I'd like to just read something that I wrote that extended my thinking about this disability of love. After Keith asked me to be a guest on his podcast, I again considered the disability of love, and I wrote these thoughts. The Russian writer Dostoevsky once said, "In every human being, a divine spark." Over the years, I've considered the implications of this quote. If we all have the same divine spark in us, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, agnostics, then divinity would be the most meaningful self-identity for everyone, including people with a disability. Imagine living in a world where the first thing you experience when you see someone in a wheelchair, is their divinity. That would be empowering. Imagine non-dualism as a globally accepted perspective with no separations between an individual and the world at large. This would create a profound shift in how we relate to each other. The nature of non-dualism is a quality consciousness, which would foster a love and honoring of the divine in everyone. Who would want to discriminate against the divine? Unfortunately, for more than 2,000 years, humans have lived with dualism, excuse me, as their most commonly shared reality. Consequently, we feel separate from everything that is outside ourself. Fears and antagonisms often develop toward people who look different, act different, or have different beliefs. They become other. Which makes them prime targets for discrimination. People with disabilities are often experienced as other. You may be thinking, yes, in a perfect world, non-dualism would be a beautiful way to live. But is there any evidence that non-dualism is a science-based reality? There is, compelling evidence. Excuse me, I'm just going to change. There is compelling evidence. For decades, quantum physics has revealed that the animating creative energy of the universe animates each of us equally, in us, as us. Tragically, this reality is widely ignored. Non-dualism certainly isn't taught in our schools, where the perspective of most teachers is that of Descartes. I think, therefore I am. With all due respect to Descartes, there is considerably more to our existence in infinite space than our mind. Spread the word. We are all divine. May non-dualism become the experience we all share on our sacred planet.
Wow, that's very profound. I was muted. But then again, I wouldn't expect anything less from knowing you the way I do. You had actually pitched the book to me and the title, the title that I came up with was Letter to an Unknown Lover, because I'm a, spoiler alert, hopeless romantic, at least I was then. And then, but the book never got written or off the ground, save that sermon, which I later redid by co-opting the title. But at that time, I didn't know jack about interviewing people at all. And it's funny how the passage of years illuminates certain things to people, because originally the impetus for this podcast, and I talked about this in season one, was originally me doing the interviews. No one would see them or hear them. And then I would write them up as a blog. But then I remembered very aptly and correctly that disability advocates don't like their stories being told by anyone but themselves. And so I changed the entire approach. But had you or anyone else predicted that as a job to me in 2017 or 2018, I would have laughed and said, "Hey man, you've got the wrong guy. That's nowhere in my wheelhouse. I don't want to do that. I like people, but interviewing them for long periods, doing research and then recording them. I mean, I've gotten very comfortable with my voice over the years. It's been a real struggle, as you well know, because I bemoaned about it a lot in terms of social and even interpersonal dynamics. But before 2019, just as the world was about to change very unexpectedly, is when this concept was born. But it took several years to get off the ground. And so going back to 2007, 2008, when the disability of love concept was pitched, I'm really glad that the book, the idea, went nowhere at that time, and we had tried to resume it several years later, but that didn't work because I wasn't ready, and talking to people about the most intimate parts of their lives was, and frankly still is, really scary and uncomfortable to me, because I'm a curious cat like yourself, yes. But I don't like to pry. I don't like to feel that I have a right to force intimacy onto people with disabilities, or anyone, but especially people with disabilities, because sometimes, oftentimes, people without disabilities think they are entitled to know everything about a person with disabilities' lives just because they're curious. And so, and I've been reminded of that again and again and again over the years. So, different book morphed into a different form, more accessible. And there are several years where I even forgot about the concept, because besides a 2015 summit I did in Arizona, it just it seemed like an insurmountable mountain, and I just didn't want to I didn't want to do it because I didn't know how. And so fast forward roughly 10 years, 10 or 11, when the concept was introduced to this concept. So I'm very thankful that the universe kept poking at it and wouldn't entirely let it be forgotten by me or and you, it seems. So we could talk forever about the stories of your life, the stories and moments that we had at the college, and rightfully so, we had only worked together for about 3 or 4 years. But the college ran into financial trouble, and as we are winding down this episode, talk about that experience and what it was like going through it, not just as a sensitive person, but also a mentor who is seeing a radical shift in every direction where he was, that really didn't need to be there or happen in the first place, had certain things aligned, but they didn't. And so, as a protector, as a mentor, what was that experience like for you?
Well, the students that I worked with in my office were really freaked out about it. And everyone who worked at the college was also freaked out. So it wasn't as if I was some placid person sitting back. Let's talk about how you feel. It was, let's talk about how we feel. Because I'm feeling everything that you're feeling. And we were given the news that the college was $35 million in debt, and that it might very well close have to close. And so it threw what was. When I first was hired at the College of Santa Fe, one of the staff members in my department referred to the college as a funky little place. It was really a creative place. It was for the arts. And so people were playing music and people were writing, and there was all this expression of a creative expression. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, and the president resigned and disappeared. I don't know what happened to him. And so what I tried to contribute what I could, certainly with working with students, but I was very upfront about, I'm feeling what you're feeling, okay? I would drive a shuttle van filled with students down to the Capitol to lobby for some sanity. And we did that for weeks.
Yeah.
But it was, sometimes people are giving you an up, it's like having an opportunity to speak, and the opportunity itself is somehow a confirmation of all voices being included. But it was just I don't think we were taken seriously. I don't, ultimately, the students were creative. They had imagination. I found the staff to be really great. They had imagination. But I can't say I found that imagination to be prevalent in the administration. Because they were the ones without the imagination to figure out how such a jewel of a place as the College of Santa Fe, they could have really done something to publicize it, but it required imagination. And
That, yeah.
yeah, that's how it felt. So it was a very rough time. And then when they announced that the college was going to close, well, students had to know, are they going to get credit? And they felt abandoned, largely abandoned, I would think. And not just think, but that's what I heard from students.
Yeah.
So it was a very rough thing. It was, talk about out of the blue, that was an out of the blue story.
And so, as we wrap up, and I ask the final questions, What did you do after the College of Santa Fe? And how did you reinvent or rediscover yourself and find that sanity?
Well, we can only hope for partial sanity.
Yes.
You know, there ain't no cure for the summertime
No.
blues.
No.
I worked basically as an entrepreneur, as a personal development coach. I worked with a number of students. Well, they were not necessarily students, but they weren't students at the time. I worked with people with disabilities. I wrote a book, Mentoring Human Potential, which included a number of stories about the College of Santa Fe as my current memoir also includes some stories from the College of Santa Fe. I was you couldn't help but be changed by the experience because you don't expect the college where you're working to close. It's highly unusual. And
Yeah.
prior to working at the College of Santa Fe, I ran a school on the Adolescent Psychiatric Unit of St. Vincent Hospital.
Yeah.
And that also closed. So I had two jobs that I really loved and that really called forth what I had to give. And I was very happy with them. So having both really good jobs close,
Yeah.
it's a punch to the gut,
Yeah.
you know, so I did a number of things, writing, certainly, and working with people,
Photography.
photography. This is an ideal Santa Fe is ideal for artists, but
Yes.
it's a tough place, you know. That's basically what I've been doing. Currently, I'm seeking people who want to write their memoirs. My thinking is, they don't have to have, I feel we all have disabilities. Let's say that up front. So it's, but that's a whole other discussion. But for people who have disabilities, I think the people I've worked with have had incredible stories. They're really incredible stories. They're largely untold stories because there's a lot of suffering that I think is part of having disabilities where you are different in one way or another from mainstream. It can be very, very painful. So what you were referring to earlier in the conversation about, as an interviewer, you don't want to feel that you're prying into those stories. My feeling is I don't want, I would feel the same way, and I do feel the same way, but I feel that the stories are very important, and they're important for people who think that they don't have disabilities, they just have problems, as we all do. We all have problems. I think that writing your stories, and I feel this way about you as well, that you're a very sensitive person. You are articulate. And it takes courage to do what you're doing. And you're providing a great service through this podcast. And I was thinking disabilities empowerment now. And what we've been discussing, I think, are contribute to empowerment. People with disabilities who want to write their stories but are intimidated or feel they don't want to reveal too much about themselves, I certainly respect that. But I can tell you from my own experience that writing my book with my stories was therapeutic. When I talked about the dog burning incident, writing about it, it's not that you just write it once. You're in a sense expiating the trauma. You're expiating the experience, the negative that is slow to leave. So writing, I found to be therapeutic. History repeats itself.
Yes.
So protest, I think is very valuable, very important, but you have to understand the structure of the society we live in. And after I did, had the dog burning and all of that, I wound up being arrested on a totally bullshit charge, but a serious charge. And it's about, how do you reclaim your name?
Yeah,
You do that. So you reclaim your name by writing a book,
yeah.
and you have the transcript that shows that the judge, and I remember this moment where the judge realized, he realized that I was telling the truth. And he basically told the district attorney, if you charge this man with such serious crimes and not put forth any evidence, not show any evidence, and then they tried to get me to agree to plead guilty to a misdemeanor. This was sale and possession of marijuana, which at that time was very serious. You could be put away for years. And I refused to plead guilty to anything. And my lawyer went back into conference with the DA and came out and he said they're willing to reduce the charges, these serious charges. I had lost a, not lost a year of my life, but it was almost a year before it went to where if I hadn't agreed to their last offer, which was to reduce the charges to disorderly conduct, I would have gone to trial. And even without evidence, I could have been found guilty. And so I had to make a decision whether to plead guilty to disorderly conduct. I thought, disorderly conduct, what does this have to do with being thrown in jail on a drug charge? Anyway, I did. I pled guilty while maintaining my innocence. And it was at that moment that the judge realized this man is telling the truth. So I hope that anyone reading that will think about their own name and their sensitivity, the sensitivity to what you're referring to about whether you really want to reveal something. It's a very personal decision. And if, but I think you handled it so well. I really do. And my hat's off for what you've created here. It's fantastic.
Thank you, my friend. And we would certainly do more episodes together, because if we don't stop talking, that will be
I know.
easily a 5 to 10 hour episode. But in wrapping up, and who would listen to that? In wrapping up, we've certainly told in a lot of stories, and some we're just beginning to tell. As my guest, what do you hope that people with disabilities take away from this episode? And what do you hope that people who have yet to discover their own disabilities take away from this episode?
Well, let's see. What I hope people will take away from it is that I hope that, and I say this in my book, on the back cover, if you were to select and write your most memorable life-shaping stories from birth to present, what would they be? Here are my stories. And I go on to basically say that I hope that my book will inspire people to write their own stories. And I hope that for anyone viewing this episode who would like to write their own memoir, this is work that I'm currently doing. And they can reach me at my website, the book's website, but includes the memoir, my work as a memoir writing coach. So if they go to outoftheblue-stories.com and just click on the link, your memoir. That's something that I would hope that people would at least investigate. Consider the possibility that writing a memoir, their memoir, can be very, very helpful, not only to them, but to anyone who reads it. You can self-publish the memoir, but I think that empowerment. This is about empowerment. Your show is about empowerment. And writing your stories, you know, there are stories that I totally respect you're not writing, but they would be quite illuminating if you did. So I think that there are a lot of people who may be viewing this who feel the same way. They'd like to be able to express themselves. They'd like to become more dimensionally visible. And writing your stories, I think allows that and allows that to happen. So there are a lot of benefits. So that's what I'd like people to take away.
Well, my friend, it had certainly been a very illuminating episode. It's always such a joy to talk to you. I can't believe we've known each other almost 20 years now, and it's been over 10 since we've actually existed in the same physical space. I look forward to bringing you back next season and talking more with you on the work you do, mentoring people with disabilities and other people as well. And I'm sure we will have many more stories to tell in the future. My best regards to you and your family.
Thank you, and my best regards to you and your family. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guest, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcast. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.